Good afternoon. As the last speaker, I get to fill a few of the gaps, and I thought maybe I'd take a slightly different approach to the other two and get a bit of a helicopter and first of all look at state financings and then sort of delve a bit further into the projects. But before I started, I thought it's in the lead up to the global crisis, what we found is that a lot of people were imputing into ratings things that weren't meant to be there. So I thought I'd just spend about 30 seconds and tell you who Standard & Poor's was. I mean, if you always wondered where the Poor's name came from, you know, why call a company poor? So there was in 1860, a man called Henry Barnum Poor wrote a publication called The History of Railroads and Canals in the United States. So he was the man who started the poor part. And then there was another company, Standard Statistics, and the two companies merged in 1941. Hence, Standard & Poor's was formed. Then in 1966, we were acquired by McGraw-Hill, the publishing company, and we're actually a division of that. So we're not a separate company, although in Australia, it's a separate company. So we're part of McGraw-Hill, you know, about 6,000 employees and 40,000 ratings worldwide. And then the other question people ask is, like, so why are you based in Melbourne? And the reason is because there are a few guys in Melbourne set up a domestic rating agency called Australian Ratings, and Standard & Poor's acquired that in 1990, so hence we moved to Melbourne, and that's why we're here. So it's a bit of history. We decided that it was important that we do a bit of market education, and I've put a web link up there, and there's a guide to ratings. It's a short book, so I commend you to read it. But there are a couple of things that come out of that. Ratings are forward-looking, and I thought this was a good segue to talk about some of the issues to do with state ratings at the moment. So everyone's looking at AAA ratings. You've seen in the press recently we've been quoted about why the United States has a AAA rating and why will it stay there. So let's look at Victoria. We have gone through each of the state's budget processes and made statements, and I've selected a couple of extracts. Strength of Victoria's balance sheet prior to the economic downturn has meant that the state has some capacity to undertake additional capital expenditure without threatening its AAA rating. So we factored into the rating the future of what the state's planning to do, and that's our statement. You know, of course, that Queensland got downgraded, but in our statement about Queensland, we said, in particular, if proposed asset sales go ahead and are consistent with the government's preliminary estimates, Standard & Poor's identified as a possible trigger to reassess the rating. So we said further that a change in the rating to AAA would require greater clarity on the timing and proceeds of asset sales and confidence that the state will deliver a structural improvement. So again, it's looking at what the state's doing and providing you with a sense of what might be required to get back to AAA. The other active state in PPPs is New South Wales, and we see a slightly different outcome here. There is minimal tolerance at the rating level for a structural weakness in finances, as this will be an indication of weak fiscal flexibility. Examples of things which may lead to a reassessment of the rating include materially stepping back from the privatisation process of electricity retail assets, materially failing to deliver on proposed savings measures and or new policies in the lead up to the March 2011 election. So what I thought now is maybe we should look at what does AAA mean. So again, you know, we're doing lots of market education at the moment. We published another article last month talking about understanding ratings definitions. So AAA is our highest rating, and therefore for an issuer to get a AAA rating, it's got to have an extremely strong capacity to meet its financial commitments under the actual conditions at the time of consideration. So one of the things we do is, and the article, the slide is titled about, talks about stress conditions. So to be a AAA rating, you've got to be able to understand a very high stress, and the sort of stress we're talking about here is something like the depression in the United States. So that will be the kind of stress we're looking at. That stress is measured in benign conditions, but then the AAA rating also has to maintain that standard that the definition says, extremely strong capacity to pay. The AAA rating is a choice. It's largely a choice. It's not total choice. But governments make a choice. Companies make a choice about what rating they want. So, why bother to be AAA? So governments look at the cost of debt, access to markets. So we've seen, even in the recent times, that when the federal government guaranteed some bank debt, that a number of states had trouble accessing markets, despite the fact that they're all AAA rated. You also look at markets and you find that not all AAAs trade at the same amount. There's also a fiscal discipline. It's a badge of honour by some governments. And so there are a lot of positive reasons for doing that. But I think a negative reason is if maintaining a AAA rating affected the way decisions were made in a way that was detrimental to the way the state was being run. So it's a choice that states make. We found that a lot of people in the lead up to the crisis expected that AAAs would pretty much not default. But in fact, in my world, everybody can default, so even AAAs. Historically, we look back over our ratings and the performance of our ratings, and a AAA historical default rate is about 0.065%. 0.65%. So it's quite low, and that's over about a 20-year period. So some AAAs default. And the important thing that we found is that in looking at AAAs, people expected that they would maintain that quality for a long time. So not all ratings have a nice leisurely path to default. Some actually can fall off a cliff. And one of the kinds of things about that might be a loss of confidence in the particular market. But for AAAs, we've now introduced a credit stability where if we felt that a rating of AAA would fall too dramatically, then we can't give it a AAA anymore. So that came in middle of last year. And so therefore, if we felt that a AAA would fall to AA within 1 year, we couldn't give it AAA anymore. So let's look at the states. We look at through the cycle, we look at the good times and bad times. The rating is through all of those times and looks at the range of outcomes. So at this time of the cycle, we expect the states to spend on infrastructure. And you've seen that they have the infrastructure forecasts and they're all in their particular budgets and they're all in their particular rating. So it's all factored into the rating looking forward. But it's important, and Glenn mentioned it. Sorry, Jeff mentioned the thing that, as far as the rating's concerned, mostly PPP debt is on the state's balance sheet. So for the credit ratings purposes, we add it back. There are a few occasions where we don't add it back, and that's where there's a real risk transfer, such as a toll road where the private sector is taking the toll risk. But for all of these, the PPP debt will be added back to the state's balance sheet and therefore form part of that analysis of the state. So as both Jeff and Glenn have mentioned, it's not just about financing, it's mostly about delivery of the projects. When we look at the world, I think it's important to understand that we go through credit market cycles. I think a couple of years ago, people had decided that credit markets had stopped going through cycles. And I think, obviously, history showed that they were wrong. So we would expect, and I think from this graph, which shows our US speculative grade portfolio, we would expect that about 14% of our total portfolio worldwide is going to default in the next year. So that's about halfway up that graph. So it's quite high, and it reflects a couple of things. It reflects that in the lead up to the crisis, there was a lot of speculative grade issuance, some very highly risky projects in the single B category that were going and accessing markets. And those are a lot of LBOs and things like that. And they haven't defaulted yet, but they basically have low document loans, and when they come to refinance in a couple of years' time, they won't be able to go to the market and access, and there will be some default and restructuring. And that will drive a lot of that. But I think when we look at this graph and we look forward, I think there's a couple of lessons we have to take away. The first is that in a 30-year financing for a PPP, there will be some market corrections, and therefore the financing has to contend with one or two of these over its entire life. I can't predict when. Clearly history shows it's about every 10 years, but you know, that's history and the future is always different. And importantly, we're looking at this graph which is showing defaults are yet to come over the next couple of years. So that will impact markets for some time to come. So even though the stock market may be thinking about things are getting better, there will be more defaults in the debt markets. And that means that when we look forward, there's going to be a bit of a trail to recovery. This is a similar graph to the one that Jeff put up. This is based on the US. And effectively, what I'm showing here is it's the spread. So the spread is the amount that a bond trades at a particular rating over and above the base rate, the reserve rate. So in this case, it's the US Treasuries. When you get a bank loan, the bank will charge you a margin over its base rate. So it's the same sort of thing. So this graph shows you over and above the cost of debt, the cost of interest rates, which has been going down, that actually the spread cost has been going up. And that means that your overall cost of debt has been going up. So when we think about the future and we're talking about short-term financing, what does that mean in 2 or 3 years' time when we have to refinance? And what will markets look like? You know, I don't know the answer. But I think we have to ask questions. So if we expect some defaults to last over the next couple of years, what will that mean about the recovery of this spread graph over time? And what will it mean for the refinancing cost of projects? And as Glenn said, you know, the state's cost of borrowings has gone up too. So, you know, it needs to be held in context that everybody's costs of funds are going up. So there is a risk in looking forward about spreads and interest rates. What will they do? What will base interest rates do? I mean, they've come down, but will they start to go up over the next couple of years? So these are questions that we can't predict. But taking a risk on that is like going to the casino. And that's really not what infrastructure projects should be doing. And therefore, really the best outcome for infrastructure projects is to have a long-term financing or a structure which mitigates this risk throughout that entire time. Because if you can't take that risk, somebody's going to take it. And I think it was Jeff said, a lot of banks are, it's either you or Glenn said, they're pushing it back to the market, the government. But it can be quite a huge risk. So it's important when we're thinking about the financing of projects, you know, where refinance will come and what that means. So let's look at the choice of projects. I think it's important that we start with the business case rather than financing case. So the project selection, is there a legacy? Well, you know, if we reduce bottlenecks, promote future growth, have good project selection, then they're good things. So it's a good thing to spend on these kinds of things. Then we start to go into some of these other things: discipline, project management, cost and time control, capacity to deliver, etc. And I think this is where, you know, Glenn showed that the PPPs have the history of delivering on time and good results. And I think this is where that benefit's brought to the state. I think they probably both agree that, and you probably mostly agree that, you know, often the states haven't had a good track record of delivering projects, you know, on budget, and there are examples where they aren't. So it's important when assessing which way you go to assess not just the financing costs. Yes, I can finance it cheaper on the state's balance sheet, but am I going to get a cheaper project? Because those other things come through, and I think one of the benefits of PPPs is it flows through to the whole government procurement model. And that means that states are actually getting better at doing it themselves in a whole range of areas. And so there's a dual benefit, not just in the projects that go through the PPP space, but those that go through the government space as well. So let's look at financing issues. PPPs have only represented about 10 to 15% of government procurement before the crisis. So the rest of government procurement is out there. We're seeing big budgets, governments needing to access the markets. But as I said before, you know, when the banks were getting the government guarantee, some states were a bit crowded out of the market. And a concern would be, if the states go and borrow lots and lots of money, will that start to crowd out other borrowers from the market? And when will the recovery come? Because we haven't seen a really, apart from a financial institution, a corporate bond issuance in the wholesale market in the last 18 months in Australia. Investors are going flight to quality, liquid markets, and that's government debt. So, you know, when's their appetite going to come back for this kind of debt? If we look at the sale of assets, remember New South Wales and Queensland both had in their outlooks statements about sale of assets. If you read most of the articles and things and you talk to investors, you see that there are two issues for investors. The first is, can I fund it if I want to buy it? And so it's okay that you want to sell it, but can somebody afford to fund it? And that's the same issue we've been talking about here. When you're selling assets as well, there's a funding issue. And the other thing is, a lot of investors are saying that the sellers want too much, and hence our comment in the Queensland thing is, if the state gets what it expects, but is the state's expectations in line with the market? And, you know, time will tell. The bond market, I agree with Jeff, you know, monolines are pretty much out of favour. Monolines added benefit where there's a pricing arbitrage, and until the pricing arbitrage comes back, then that's unlikely to be a financing tool. But I think it also needs to be borne in mind that what the monolines did was more than just provide cheap financing. They also provided a party that was standing for the bondholders who actually understood the risks and was able to manage the risks on their behalf. And that gave a lot of bondholders confidence. And without them in the market, there may be a lack of interest by some bondholders. So that role of the monolines, yeah, created long-term financing. Bank debt, you know, one of the issues, and I'm going to have to disagree with Jeff a little bit here, 20-plus banks, there is a couple of issues. Banks are doing club deals at the moment. A club deal is where four or five banks get around the table and they all agree and negotiate the loan together. That's different from a syndicated deal where one bank gets in, negotiates the deal, and then sells it to its counterparties. Banks are worried about counterparty risk, so nobody's taking the risk of selling down to others. And when you start to get 20 or more banks, you start to come into the risks of the marginal bank, that last bank that came in, wants a few more terms that nobody else wants. So while ANZ might have done its due diligence, it's now taking the risk on this other bank behaving properly, and also the other things that this bank may want in the deal. So I think, and you probably agree, that there are some issues around the size of banking clubs as we are in the moment. And clearly the short-term financing creates this refinancing risk that I talked about. So one of the things that all funders have to do at the moment, whether you do it through state funding of the project or, you know, bank funding, is to look for this exit strategy. In what way will we, when markets recover, will you be able to go to a range of markets and refinance in something that's more appropriate to the type of project? And I thought I'd finish up with a little bit of a crystal ball gazing. Where do we think the market will be? Everyone's going to be more conservative, debt and equity. Everyone's going to spend more time doing due diligence. They're going to want greater transparency. People are going to focus on operating cash flows. There's a fear of complexity and financial engineering, and so they want to get returns that actually are generated from the project, not by some financial engineer. There's that rebalancing of risks. You know, the governments have had a lot of private sector parties chasing after projects for a while, and they've been prepared to take great risks, and now they're not prepared to take those risks. So now there needs to be a rethink about where does the balance fit in the new world. And, you know, I had to finish on the note, greater emphasis on credit risk, because that's what I do. But I do have one more that I haven't put up there. And again, I'm going to have to sort of add a different flavour to Peninsula Link. I think while the market is definitely being concerned about patronage risk, in an availability toll road, there is still traffic risk. And by that I mean, if I have a lot of trucks or too many cars drive down that road, they're going to wear the road out a lot faster, and hence my maintenance cost is going to be increased. So even on availability roads, there is still an element of managing the traffic risk. And that can be done in a variety of ways, but somewhere along the way, somebody takes that risk and somebody has to pay for it. So thank you very much.